Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Cheryl Ney. Today's session number is 98-3, and it's titled, The Chemical Basis of Life, Connectedness of All Creatures. Let's listen in.
To be able to see biochemically, why are we going to go through the work? To put it simply, where we know more, we see more. Right, so we actually sometimes see with our heads, right? So what we want to work on today is developing a biochemical lens. So some of you may have some form of a biochemical lens to look at the world already, so you can dust your lens off. Some of you perhaps need to begin to develop one if you're not used to this way of viewing the world, so we'll work on developing a beginning biochemical lens. Then I have a couple of important focal points I want to work on building in these lenses that we're going to be establishing. And then we're going to spend just a little bit of time talking about DNA. We've started this morning isolating DNA from an onion with common kitchen everyday stuff. So we'll get to that there towards the end. And then, of course, we need to take a moment to think about how all of this connects to the village theme, This Summer Guide Our Feet. All right, so what we need to do is for you to imagine that you're putting on a pair of lenses different than the ones you may already wear, right? Anybody not wear glasses or lenses in this room? So I think we've all had that experience of putting on a pair of lenses and to see more, right? Or you put those lenses on for the first time and they're not the right lens, and what happens? Can't see nothing, all right? So what we want to do is work on seeing through biochemical lenses. And I thought maybe to give us some motivation to do that, we should first of all think about all these living creatures that we want to try to analyze here in Holden Village. So I brought in some props. I couldn't actually bring in the actual living creatures here in Holden, but I brought in some props to stimulate your imagination. So let's think for a moment before we try to see through these new lenses about these creatures that we share the environment with here in Holden. What are some of your favorites that you encounter? What are the living things here at Holden that come to your mind? Let's make a long list.
The deer in all the backyard.
The deer, okay.
The deer.
The deer?
I also like the robins and the chipmunks or squirrels.
Okay. Squirrel. Robins, chipmunks, squirrels. What else have we got here?
Big frogs?
Huge frogs. Snakes?
Yep. Walk at night down towards the ball field.
Really? Okay. Snakes. I saw a snake on the trail the other day. Other living creatures here.
Bears.
Cougars. Have you seen a cougar here?
Last winter when I was up here. Yeah. Okay.
Other living things. We're leaving out some categories here. Thinking of our favorite. Mice.
Lots of mosquitoes.
Insects. Mosquitoes. Ladybugs. We saw a ladybug on the trail the other day. All right.
I saw one way up there in the place.
A ladybug? Isn't that something? What other? We're leaving out another category.
Okay, what else? Salmon down at Lucerne. I haven't seen any fish up here, but I've been up to Old Mike here.
We saw Mike caught some rainbow trout and a cutthroat trout the other day when we were up there. So you could actually, the lake is so clear that you can actually see the fish.
At Holden?
Yeah. Not high up. 1,200 feet, but boy, is it worth it. Other living things that come to mind here at Holden?
Little flowers.
All right. Have you got some favorites?
I like the daisies.
Daisies?
And they kind of come up in spikes, so they remind me of gladiolus.
Uh-huh. Long-stem daisies, mm-hmm. Right.
The wildflowers along the paths, they're just delicate.
Aren't they something? All different colors, all different sizes. Up in Holden, I noticed there was this fir-like bush that had these little tiny delicate pink flowers on the end. All right. Any other living things that come to mind when we're thinking about
them? Unbelievably huge trees.
Yes, right. How can we forget the trees? Right. How can we forget the trees? Right.
The septic system works. It better be bacteria.
Yeah, right. Bacteria. Right. Well, there's plenty of microbes in the dirt. Just in the dirt itself, there's plenty of microbes. So the place here is teeming with living systems. So let's now take some time now to try to see how a biochemist might see these living things. So as I said, let's put on a pair of lenses, a pair of frames that perhaps don't have any lenses yet. And let's spend just a few minutes developing sort of a basic lens to look through. So we want to work on your biochemical lens, okay? If you've already got one, you might want to just take it off and dust it a little bit. It's been a while before you've thought of it. So what we do, the very first thing we do as biochemists when we look through these lenses is we realize that 20th century science has given us an explanation for what we see in the world in terms of material stuff, and that explanation is that all living things are composed of atoms and molecules. All right, so we look at the flowers here, and we can think about atoms and molecules of the flower, atoms and molecules of the bear, atoms and molecules of the fish. All right, to a biochemist, it's all atoms and molecules. So hopefully now you're starting to see something with your biochemical lens. You can think about the idea of atoms and molecules. Let's try to sharpen up that image of atoms and molecules. You may remember that atoms are the building block of matter, of stuff. So I was working with the 4 and 6 year olds yesterday, and so we talked about how you could take something and chop it down and chop it down and chop it down and chop it down and get to its most fundamental building block, and that building block would be smaller than the tiniest piece of sand, right? So we talked about that with the 4 to 6 year olds. Or a good metaphor would be to think of the world as being composed of Legos, right? That you can think of atoms as Legos, all right? So I remember that atoms are the smallest unit of matter that a chemist cares about. So we're not going to worry about forks and charms and all things like that. We'll just stick with the atoms. And then you may recall that the relationship between atoms and molecules is that we take different atoms and join them through bonds to form molecules. All right? And then finally, if we're going to see the world through this lens, we need a visual metaphor for atoms. And so what we often use in science, in chemistry, is that we use colored spheres to represent different atoms. All right, so for example, in water molecules, we have 2 hydrogen atoms of pure blue and an oxygen atom of pink. All right? So now, even with that limited understanding of atoms and molecules, we can now see stuff in a way that we haven't seen before. All right? So what I'd like you to do is take a minute to pick some living stuff, maybe your hand, maybe the flowers, and just take a minute and see what you can see in terms of thinking about these molecules bonded with these collections of atoms. Now, I should tell you that in living systems, we only use a small number of atoms. What are the atoms we use in living systems to make living stuff?
Carbon. Hydrogen.
Oxygen, hydrogen.
Nitrogen.
What's an important atom for DNA? You biochemists out there? Phosphorus, all right? And your hair, what do you get when you burn your hair? What happens? What do you smell?
Sulfur,
all right? And then there's a whole bunch of other used in much less quantity. So we're only talking about a handful of atoms. So maybe in your mind, think of 6 colors, all right? You want to join these colors as spheres through bonds to make molecules. And let's just take a minute to reflect on what the world looks like when you make this subdivision. Now, you really gotta use your imagination, right? So take a minute, maybe focus on the daisies. Look at those atoms and molecules in those leaves. Can't you see them? Can you see those carbon atoms in the daisies? Can you?
Not individually, but collected.
A whole bunch, so you see a mass of carbon atoms, okay? Good, good. How about the molecules that are coming out of your mouth? What's coming out here?
Carbon dioxide.
What's the other important gas? Water. Can't you see those water molecules? Look at them filling the room here, right? All right? It's a different way of experiencing the world. All right? So I want you to try for the next hour. All right. Let's take a moment and add some more depth to the vision. So at the moment with your lens, all you're seeing really is tiny spheres of different colors, right? All right, so that's some kind of a biochemical view. Let's develop that focal a little deeper by zeroing in on one particular atom. I chose carbon. Let's look at carbon in depth. Why would I want to look at carbon in depth when we're talking about living things? Anybody know?
Everything that's alive has to have carbon.
Right, we have carbon-based life form, and as far as we know, so far, that's all we've seen for life. Now, I had a friend who was working on one of those Viking projects, and apparently there was a moment in that project where they thought perhaps the rocks were excreting and replicating, and for a moment, a brief moment, they thought perhaps there was a silicon-based life form on Mars. But that has proven not to be the case, as far as we know. All right? So when it comes to living stuff, the basic unit of matter for living things is the carbon atom. So let's take a moment to pick a model of the carbon atom to deepen our understanding. We'll pick the simplest model that chemists use, and that happens to be an early 20th century model. So there is a quantum mechanical model, but we don't have time to develop that one for our eyes yet this morning. And so this early 20th century model is named after the scientist who first began to think about these things, the Bohr model, or perhaps you remember this from school, grade school. We talked about the shell model. Remember that? Nope? Okay. All right. So if we went to divide this, let's do a dissection on this carbon atom. What are we going to find in it? Let's be like a biologist. Dissection.
Neutrons
and protons, and what else?
Electrons.
All right, so let's arrange these parts in our carbon atom according to the shell model, and so you remember perhaps how it goes. We'll put the protons and the neutrons at the very center, and that's the nucleus. All right, and we'll just worry about protons pretty much. That's all chemists have to do unless they're nuclear chemists. So we'll just think about the six protons in that very hard center. And then it turns out, which is difficult to show in my drawing, that there's a vast space before we get to this first shell, that where two electrons, according to the model, move around randomly and wildly. All right, so here's now where we start to get our shells. We have an inner core, which is the nucleus. We have the shell of two electrons. And then you see the way things are organized for reasons we can't discuss here. There's another outside shell that has four electrons in it. All right, so I think a good metaphor for atoms, according to the shell model, is to think of the onion. Right, when you slice down the middle of the onion and you open it up, you see the hard center, and then you see the layers. All right? Here we're talking about a very small atom. It only has six protons and a total of six electrons. So we can push the metaphor even further to think about those lovely pearl onions that they use in martinis, or some people use. All right, so the carbon atom, of course, would be a little tiny pearl onion, and something like the uranium atom would be our Vidalia onion, right? Those big, great big with lots of shells. All right, so now you have more to see, right? So let's take a moment again to think about our daisy. I don't know, the white petals, the yellow center. Are there any biologists out there? What's that yellow center called? I'm a chemist, I don't know. What's that?
It's the stamen and pestle.
Stamen and pestle that are yellow. Or you might think about the stem there. And remember we said that it's teeming with carbon atoms. And now you have a picture of the carbon atom that you can apply. All right? Questions or comments about what we've done so far with your lens? Need any guidance or further help in how to see the carbon atom in the living stuff or the carbon atoms in the carbon dioxide that we're pushing out of our lungs? You all with me on this? It's a little hard to see in here. I can't see your faces. All right, so you're moving along with your focal. All right. So what I'd like to do now is really move towards a specifically biochemical focal point for your lens and talk about something that's special about the molecules in living systems, all right? And for me to explain this special characteristic of molecules in living systems, I'm going to make an analogy, all right? And I'm going to make an analogy with some things. I don't know if you'll be able to see here. Maybe I can just set them up here on the... So there's a penny, there is a nail file, and then I have this complicated thing right here, and I'd like you to focus on this part of the thing right here. So I have three objects. Can you think of something that I could do with one thing that I could do with all three of these objects?
I could throw it.
Yeah, I could throw them, okay, so I could test my throwing power, that's good. And you had
possibly turn a screw.
Possibly turn a screw, right? That in desperate measure we could try turning that penny with the screw. Let's focus on that turning of the screw. Which device would you want to use if you had to turn a screw to save your life?
Well,
okay. Obviously, this one is well built to match what we experience with screws. All right, so this gives us the idea that if we've got a tool and it's got a specific job, what can we conclude? What do we want to make sure when we design our tools?
We want it to function.
Right? We want to design our tools so that they carry out the function that we have in mind. Right, well, guess what? Biochemists now in the 20th century understand biomolecules by realizing that they are designed to carry out their function. Or what we say in biochemistry, gravity. We're not talking about gravity today, we're talking about atoms. What we can say about molecules and living systems. Jerry,
I was better. See, I have a degree in theology.
Jerry, leave it. We gotta go through the home here. Thanks.
Use the right tool.
Yeah. That's very good. All right, so what we say about molecules of living systems, the molecules in living systems are like tools. They are designed, perhaps, to carry out a job, which is a specific job. So the biochemists describe it like this. The structure of a biomolecule is designed to meet its function. So we say for all molecules of living systems, there's this structure-function relationship. Now this idea is obviously something that we can relate to our experience, we relate it with tools. Where else, in what other field do we find this structure-function kind of relationship?
Architecture.
Architecture, and how do the architects describe it?
Form and function.
Form follows function, right? So it's the same kind of understanding that we have, interestingly, right? The human mind does architecture, the human mind does science, and one thing that biochemists have noticed is that it works very well to take this idea that the structure of a biomolecule is designed to meet its function. Now, clearly I don't have tons of time here to make my case, and so I want to try to make my case for this rather simply. All right. So if we were in a biochemistry course, we'd start writing structures and what have you, but we don't have time to do that today. So I just want to make the case to show you what I mean, that the structure of a biomolecule is designed to meet its function. So I'll take this item from which we would consider a living system, or recently formally a living system. All right. It's going to breathe for a little while longer. And we know, what does your biochemical lens tell you about this?
It's composed of atoms and molecules.
Thank you very much. It's composed of atoms and molecules, and what atom predominates?
Carbon.
Carbon atom. Can't you see those six protons in the nucleus and the two? All right. So this piece of celery is composed of atoms and molecules. I want to focus on a particular molecule in celery here, if I can use a careful technique. And that particular molecule is found here. Anybody know what molecule we find consists of these celery strings? Want to take a guess? It's the same molecule you find in trees. Let's make your trees and your stems stand tall. Is that lignin? That's more like a glue. So we're talking about the chief component, cellulose. All right? So you can see that what we need from this molecule, cellulose, is we need it to be fairly straight. I mean, you can't get much straighter than the strings on this celery, all right? Well, guess what? The structure of cellulose is a very linear molecule if you examine it, all right? So there we have an example of, we need, the strings are built so that they're straight, so we need a molecule that's straight. All right, so there's a simple, we could draw the structures and I could show you how the glucose units are arranged to give this straight molecule, but we don't have time for that. So I think that's a pretty good example of structure related to function. Let's take one more, and that has to do with you as a living system. What happened to you this morning when you were in the shower? All that water, or limited amount of water, that came down and down upon you in the shower this morning, all right? Probably took off a layer of dead cells, right? By and large, did you wash down the drain? As far as we know, our basic composition doesn't change every time we take a shower, because our molecules of our skin have been designed to be water insoluble. All right, so there's another example of we need a protective coating that is water insoluble, all right, and so the structure of the molecules in your skin are, they won't dissolve in water by and large. All right, so that's sort of a limited example of the idea of the structure-function relationship in biomolecules. So now let's think about our living things. All right, let's see. Let's take our bear here. Let's see, our bear eats, what do bears eat?
Everything, omnivores.
Ah, they eat meat too?
Yes.
I didn't realize that, okay. So imagine in your bear there's a molecule called a protein. What could we say about, and that protein's job is to digest the muscle of a chipmunk. Okay? So what can we say now as biochemists as we stare into that protein molecule in the gut of our little tiny bear there? We can be for certain that the structure of that protein molecule is designed to carry out that function. All right. So now, whenever you're given a name of a biomolecule, you can say, I know it has a structure, and I know it has a function. All right? Let's take a moment to maybe think about some biomolecule names that you're familiar with. What molecules are you made out of? What's the molecule in highest abundance in you?
Water.
Water, right? And so what we can say is that water has a function, probably many functions in you, and water's structure of H2O really helps, is carefully plays into the function of water in you. Other molecules in you that some of you are familiar with. Let's ask Bob, our pharmacist. Can I put you on the spot? Pick a molecule.
Collagen.
Collagen, all right, in muscle, right? Is that right? I'm not a physiologist either. I'm only a DNA biochemist.
I think so. Connective tissue.
Connective tissue, all right. So think about the collagen material in connective tissue. We know it's performing a function there. We know it has a structure, and the structure of that collagen molecule works beautifully to carry out the function. All right, so we could go on and on. So now, I mean, what a gift I've given you. You hear a biomolecule and you can say, well, I know two things about it, right? I know that it has a structure, three things. I know it has a function, and I know that the structure is related to the function. All right, so right away, without having to get a PhD in biochemistry, you can think biochemically. All right? Okay, so that's an important focal. Let's add just another one here to give us a little more information to be dangerous. So we'll add one more focal. And this comes from the point in history that we're at. There, I think I've got a system now. Whatever. All right. This comes from the point in history that we're at. Biochemistry is a field that's been around for some time now, and so we have enough information that we can begin to classify our biomolecules. So we can now imagine taking all the molecules from living systems from across the globe, right, and putting it out here on our fire ring, okay? If we put all those molecules out here, we can begin to sort them by type because we have enough of them, all right? It turns out that we can get basically four categories of molecules, right? So many of which I think you're familiar with. We have the molecules which are called lipids, and so these would be examples of fats and oils. All right, so we're talking about the oil on your skin, the padding that some of us have in places where we don't want it. All right, that would be fats. Steroids are considered in the lipid family, so cholesterol would be included in that. Waxes, you know, that stuff in your ear. All right, that's a lipid. And the membranes around your cells are lipids as well. All right, so there's this whole category of lipids. For our biochemists or chemists out there, what's a major characteristic of these lipid molecules? What would happen if I had water and this stuff?
Fatty.
Right? Fatty, water insoluble. So lipids are characterized only by water solubility or insolubility. So these lipids are water insoluble. All right, here's another familiar category of molecules, the carbohydrates. So we find carbohydrates in the starch of a potato, the cellulose of our celery. The sugar storage form is glycogen, and your liver is, by and large, has got a great deal of glycogen. So as you look at a potato, You and a potato are connected because the potato stores its glucose in starch. You store that glucose in your liver in the form of glycogen. All your simple sugars. When you think of simple sugars, what names come to mind?
Glucose,
fructose, sucrose, disaccharide, mannose. All right. All those sugars would fall into the carbohydrate fat family. Here I put lactose. I was thinking of the kids here drinking milk, so we're getting milk sugar, lactose out of that. All right, another important category of molecules in living systems would be the proteins. All right, and here I've picked just a couple of examples. Of course, it's the enzymes in us that catalyze almost everything we do here, especially our metabolism. All right, so when you eat your GORP on the trail, it's your enzymes that go to work and metabolize that GORP so that you can get up the hill or down the hill, depending on where you are. Here's another important protein, hemoglobin, which apparently we're in very short supply of. If you're new to the village nurse said yesterday that it takes 30 days for you to get to the same level of hemoglobin in your system that you had when you were 3,000 feet lower. I think I characterized that correctly. Hemoglobin protein, antibodies protein, insulin is a peptide protein, keratin, your hair, remarkably your hair, your nails, the bird's claw, the tortoise's shell are all made of the same material, and that's keratin. All right? And you biochemists out there, what's the building block of proteins? What's the smallest unit? Yeah, the amino acids, right? So even in this category, we can talk about the building blocks as well. So we use amino acids as a building block. And then the last category is a category that seems to be in the news a lot here in the last part of the 20th century. Those would be the nucleic acids. So we have DNA, all the different RNAs. There's messenger RNA, transfer RNA, small nuclear RNA, heteronuclear RNA, and ribosomal RNAs that I could remember when I was writing out my chart. All right, so we have another group of molecules that have certain characteristics. All right, what can we say about all these molecules and all these groups? They have a structure, they have a function. The way we understand them is that structure relates to the function. And also we can say they're made of atoms, and those atoms are joined to form the structures of all these molecules.
I think your question.
Okay.
The membrane around a cell is semi-permeable. Well, it doesn't completely keep things out. So is it a hybrid or is it a particular kind? I mean, are you...
Okay. These membrane lipids, they automatically form your cell membranes called bilayers. And that bilayer structure, it has an outer layer of charge and an inner layer of charge. And so small charge molecules can diffuse through your cell membranes. And also, your cell membranes have specific transporter systems. So you can think of maybe like a school bus that drives in and out proteins or is an ion channel and things like that. So your cells get additional structures in them to carry out additional functions like you're thinking about. Good question. Other questions you might want to ask about your, now we're talking about your molecules, right? This is you. Isn't that something? To a biochemist, you are.
What would, then of the other three then, what would be the transporter? I mean, if the lipid would keep it out, what transports it?
Anybody want to answer that? Go ahead. What do you think?
I'm sorry.
What's the transport molecule on the cells?
It must be protein.
Yeah, proteins. Proteins, pretty much, as far as we know, proteins are your transport molecules. Actually, they're big protein complexes, fairly sophisticated. Other questions or comments about your molecules?
Yes, well, you mentioned the hemoglobin takes 30 days to reach its full point. So would that contribute to people's fatigue when they first arrive? Or I thought it was just that I was exhausted getting here.
Absolutely.
I thought it was because I hiked in 20 miles.
You also have this factor of your elevation. Yeah?
I used to know, but I've forgotten.
Sure.
This explains why some people have straight hair and others have curly hair.
Uh-huh.
Aren't there more like
cross-links? Right. It's the sulfur cross-link in your hair that holds a curl. So one strand has a sulfhydryl sticking out, another strand has a sulfhydryl sticking out, and you roll it on the roller and you put the chemicals on it and you form that sulfur bond, disulfide, right? And we know that we've got sulfur in our hair because when we burn it, you can smell that sulfur. Too good a story to pass up. Another example of how you prove that you have sulfur in proteins comes from Margaret Thatcher, who, as you may or may not know, was a chemist. Margaret Thatcher was a chemist. So here's Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, out in the schools, and she's gone to some grade school group of kids, and it's in the inner city. And I don't know, they're studying eggs or something, and she's trying to show her chemical knowledge to these young children, and she says, well, you know, there's sulfur in your eggs. And they go, you know, they don't know about sulfur in their eggs. She says, well, you know what happens when you take your silver spoon and you eat your egg? It gets oxidized.
Your working class.
Yeah, all those kids have silver spoons to them. Poor Margaret. One of those moments that different perspective didn't help explain the chemistry, right? So there are ways that we can show that we have sulfur, for example, in us. All right, so why don't we again take a moment to do a little bit of connecting. So pick a living system here, take a moment and see what you can see. I don't know, you might want to make big complicated structures with different colors in them to represent these different kinds of molecules. Now look at your stuff, or look at the green leaves of the arrangement here, and what you can see, of course, as a chemist is the carbon atoms, the molecules. You can now say to yourself, well, I know in that green leaf there are four kinds of molecules, and those four kinds of molecules are lipids, carbohydrates, proteins, and nucleic acids. All right? So, again, I'm making the point when you know more and you can see more, if you work hard, right? I mean, you really have to work hard at this one.
Okay, I have a vision here.
Please.
So we've got a subway tunnel made out of lipids, and the train on it is the protein.
Okay.
And the carbs are what fires the engine, makes it go. But what does
nucleic acids?
Nucleic acids do in the...
In that metaphor?
Right.
Station master.
Tell you what to do.
The DNA would specify the code for the construction of the proteins involved in the transport process.
Okay.
Right? That's a good metaphor, yeah.
The thing that blows me away is that there's not a clear boundary between us and the rest of the world. And like when we smell bread baking, we're taking on some of the bread molecules into ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And when a mosquito bites us, they fly away with some of our molecules.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Oh, wow. That is really wonderful.
I mean...
That is really wonderful.
It makes you question, you know, what you are. And like, we're breathing in here. We're taking on each other's molecules.
That's really lovely.
It's weird to think about.
It's really lovely. It's really lovely. You have a different experience, a different understanding when you can take it all that way. That's really wonderful.
So does everything have all four, no matter what?
Everything that's alive.
Everything that's alive.
Has all four.
I guess I would want to be a little careful. I would want to say almost always, because there's always some kind of strange fungi at the bottom of the ocean or something.
Well, viruses are kind of odd creatures too.
Right. Right. So the viruses don't have the lipids and the carbohydrates. They've got these two down here. So that's getting really small. You had a comment?
Well, my granddaughter has a disorder and it's genetic, and she doesn't have the enzymes to break down the proteins and the saccharides. How do you find that out? I mean, I'm from the Minnesota, University of Minnesota, and they send out to New York and they have all this genetic specialist, and it blows my mind. I don't know.
Right, that's right.
They can pin down one little thing.
That's right.
And then it ends up storing in every cell of her body.
That's right.
Cell, you know, so it's...
So the other experience of splendor that we have there is the splendor of the human mind, right? That that somehow on this planet we can get all these people working together.
To say which little enzyme, I mean, they've got that one little teeny tiny enzyme pinned down.
Exactly. And to push that one step further, guess what? There is plenty that we don't understand. I mean, that's one thing that we do understand, but even more.
So that's what's going on. Is like in AIDS, there's cancer research or whatever. They've got a function that they want, and so they're searching for the form that will fit the function. They're kind of going backwards to find.
Sometimes that's a strategy for making a pharmaceutical. In things like diseases, of course, what you've got is abnormal function, something off of the ordinary.
Let's go back to the virus for
just sure.
A virus is a thief then, because it just has the proteins and the acids, and it steals the lipids and carbohydrates from other cells in order to. I mean, isn't that essentially what's going on in your body when a virus invades? It's using your lipids.
It uses your apparatus.
Right. So it's like a mockingbird.
Sometimes.
It lays its eggs in other nests and or a cuckoo.
But a virus is more of a mechanical, robotic thing. It's more of chemistry than it is biology, or more of physics, I think, than it is biology.
It's very fundamental, stripped down.
It's like a robot without a living sense.
Making breakfast.
We're working on getting some DNA out here.
It actually smells pretty good. At first I thought it was me.
Kind of related to the virus idea, of course, is, and sort of related to your idea as well, is that we as human organisms carry along a lot of bacteria, right? We in fact depend on the bacteria in our guts for certain metabolites and vitamins and things like that. So we are a living, walking, symbiotic thing. Right? All right, well, you're making great connections. I'm really very appreciative of this. So let's push it even further and focus in on one particular molecule, and that's the molecule that we're going to try to work on over here and see if we can get some of it for you today. And that, of course, is DNA. All right, because that's the molecule in the news right now a lot. So let's take a minute to think about DNA. Let's start by thinking about your DNA. One way to think about your DNA is to realize that if we could take out one of your cells, just one of your cells, and we could unravel your chromosomes and we could stretch them from end to end, from one set of your chromosomes, that DNA would measure a meter in length. Now, it'd be very long, but it'd be really thin, right? All right, so again, we kind of get the wonder of living systems. How do you do that? How do you take something that's a meter in length and cram it into a tiny cell which has a diameter of, like an average liver cell has a diameter of 20 micrometers? So how are you going to do that? Well, guess what? The structure of DNA relates to how you can coil it up and cram it in that cell, and you get a little help from proteins and what have you. So we very much depend on structure relates to function there. Some more things about your DNA. First of all, we said that was DNA from one of your cells, and I had a student once do a rough calculation. They came up with the idea that you are roughly 4 trillion cells, give or take a billion, right? All right, so that means another student did the calculation to say that a dog, an average dog, is roughly 2 trillion cells. All right, so think of your 4 trillion cells, and in each one of those cells you have this piece of DNA which is roughly a meter in length, all right? And what's remarkable about that piece of DNA is that every single one of your 4 trillion cells has the same composition, more or less, of DNA. All right, so every single one of your 4 trillion cells, but it gets more complicated than that, because you have to remember that every single cell that you have doesn't necessarily carry out the same function. So hopefully your brain cells are doing different things than your big toe cells. As far as we know, there's not much thinking going on down here. All right. However, there's some question about gut. We know that there's a brain-gut connection. Right? You have peptides from your gut going into your brain. So, you know, what's that all about? Your brain is highly your gut is highly innervated. What's that all about? But the main point here is that every cell doesn't do the same thing. Well, how does that work? All right, well, the only way that can work is if If every cell is different, but yet they have the same DNA, that must mean that somehow your DNA is regulated. You have to turn on your brain cell genes up here, and you have to turn off those brain cell genes down there, your big toe. And guess what? This is one of the biggest mysteries that end of 20th century scientists, biochemists, and molecular biologists are still trying to crack, is we haven't really got some ideas about how DNA is regulated, but haven't cracked it completely. All right, we should say when we're thinking about DNA, a word about how DNA functions. I just remember that I've forgotten that in the story. This idea about DNA function. We have a 1950s version of explaining how DNA functions in the cell. It's probably what most of you are familiar with. It's called the master molecule theory. If you've studied DNA at all, this is probably what you studied. That it's the master molecule theory for explaining how cells function, and it says what?
DNA is the master
in charge, and that DNA functions to specify the production of RNAs, and those RNAs specify the structure of these proteins. And in a 50s version that I've seen from an old textbook, these proteins were called workhorses. Now that's Albert Leninger's version of what a protein does. I don't know if he was a farm boy or what have you. Sometimes when I'm teaching chemistry like this to nurses, I think about those proteins as housewives. It worked all right in the early 80s, but now almost all my students, their moms work, so not even that is a good metaphor anymore. All right. So somehow we have these proteins who are doing a lot of the work of the cell, and in this 50s theory, when people first started thinking about this, these particular people, for reasons we could discuss, came up with the idea that DNA is the master molecule. Right, you might want to think of Leave It to Beaver and...
Hey, I'm back here. This is when I took it.
Okay.
Exactly.
You remember this.
DNA, RNA.
You're remembering it.
Yeah, right.
Well, time has marched on, and the people who do this science now, their composition has changed. They're a much more heterogeneous group doing science. And what they've come to realize is that it's not at all the idea of a master molecule here, but rather we've got lots of cooperation and collaboration going on. That instead, a better explanation for how DNA works is that DNA can't function unless you have proteins. So it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. So over time, as our understanding has evolved, as the humans involved in thinking about how DNA works, our theories have changed a bit. And so now we realize that DNA is just one part of a mysterious process that we don't fully and completely understand. Other questions or comments, things you want to add about DNA that you all might know about? How's our procedure coming?
Slow.
We're stuck at the... what we've done here is that I went and asked the cooks there to give me an onion, and they chopped up an onion, and of course the onion consists of cells. And so what we've done with salt and soap is to sort of break up the tissue of the onion here, and as soon as we get this soap mixture through the funnel, we're going to bust open the cell and the nuclear membrane. And when we bust open that cell and the nuclear membrane, we can have the DNA kind of spill out, and we can actually isolate it. Now you might ask, how do you bust open a cell membrane? Well, guess what? You go to your kitchen cabinet and you get Adolph's meat tenderizer, and that'll open the cell. I got this off the internet. A student of mine found this for me on the internet. Find DNA in your kitchen. The Utah Museum of Natural History.
www.finddnainyourkitchen.com.
Yeah, I wish. yeah. Just remember Utah. Utah Museum of Natural History, if you want to try it. I don't know if we're going to actually... anything coming through?
Slowly.
It seems like I remember using meat tenderizer when you have a bee sting.
Oh.
And apply it to that.
Oh.
So that's that breaks open the cell, and then the DNA comes out?
All kinds of things would spill out then.
So something in that process helps.
Huh, the sting.
It's like a jellyfish, it's the same as a meat sting. Now I have a meat sting allergy. Do you have any meat in your age?
I did not know that. I did not know that. Well, we're getting DNA out there. Let me show you some dried DNA that we have. This would come from calf thymus. Now remember, again, a way to connect with, to feel this unity with all living things is that this model is how we understand that almost all living things work. We're going to leave out the virus because the virus is, well, no, the virus has got protein, so we could say all living things. As far as we know, everything that lives is using this, we explain the life of every living thing using this model here.
Do you include rocks then in the living things since they do have molecules but they are slower?
We probably wouldn't include rocks because one of the criteria for living systems is you have to be able to use, extract, and transform energy. Mm-hmm. So as far as we know, the rock isn't, as far as we know, doing any business of using or generating energy. So we put that in the non. And the composition of a rock would bear that up because is there a rock that has carbon in it? There must be carbonate.
Rocks.
What's
no,
that?
Kidding,
it has to use,
extract, and transform energy. So how do you do that?
Well, I don't, but I eat,
you eat,
digest.
Right, and metabolize.
But I'm just trying to think of radioactive isotopes transform.
Hmm. It's fun to play with the definitions and try to figure out what is life and what isn't. Another part of a definition is replication. As far as we know, rocks don't self-replicate, as far as we know.
I mean,
we don't know what goes on. What?
If you have a garden, they do.
Yeah, that's right. So there are a couple of criteria which really help narrow down what is living and what is not. But there is an episode there's a great episode on the Next Generation, the Star Trek Next Generation, mm-hmm. where Data communicates with a crystal.
The crystalline entity.
The crystalline entity, yeah. Right. So who knows?
But rocks do have active atoms, right, that are constantly moving?
Sure. Lots of atoms. Much more diversity in the kinds of atoms you find in rocks than you would find in living systems. So iron, sulfur, aluminum, copper, magnesium, all those metal ions. So yeah, but they're all composed of atoms as well. So that's a chemical perspective on the whole world, is that all matter is living systems. And remember, we were working on our biochemical perspective, and so we just were looking at living systems. Here's some dry DNA. It's pretty remarkable what happens when you take DNA out of the cell and dry it. You getting anything through there?
Yes.
This is my DNA assistant, my husband.
Yeah.
He's doing a nice job here.
It's working. It's taking a long time.
Yeah.
You're studying to be a lawyer, so?
Yeah.
I'm a half-assed lawyer.
Charging by an hour?
Yeah, right.
We should say a little bit more about the world of DNA in terms of where we are. Let's see, you're looking at some DNA from dried DNA from calf thymus. Is it possible to get DNA out of you?
Sure.
Who does that? Who would care about your DNA?
The police.
Right, forensics. And what cells can they use now to get DNA out of you?
Dried blood.
Blood cells.
Hair.
Skin cells. Hair cells. I heard a report recently that a fingernail clipping will provide enough DNA for a scientist now to work on characterizing your DNA. Because they do have a technology, it's called the PCR technology, which replicates the DNA. So if you have one copy of the DNA, it's like this magnificent Xerox machine that doesn't require toner. It's copies and copies and copies of DNA. So now all it takes is one fingernail clipping to get that DNA.
Wasn't that the premise in Jurassic Park?
They were using the DNA of a mosquito that had bitten a dinosaur, and that mosquito was embedded in amber. Steven Spielberg says that Jurassic Park is not science fiction, it's science eventuality. Fortunately, nature is a lot more complicated than even our best scientists and There's even some question right now about Dolly. Remember Dolly the sheep? She was reported to be cloned from a cell of her mother. So you take the cell out of mommy, and you take the cell out of mommy, you get the DNA out of mommy, and then you make Dolly the sheep. And apparently there's still a little bit of uncertainty. There is a faction in the scientific community which is still questioning the results because the results weren't all published. And apparently mommy had just recently had a miscarriage. And so there is a small chance that the cell they took out of mommy was actually a fetal cell, in which case it wouldn't have been mom's DNA. So they're still not sure about Dolly. Of course, there was a cow, I guess, recently cloned here in the States. So it's moving along, that DNA technology.
Can you elucidate on chromosomes and how they fit into the DNA structure? I studied molecular biology 100 years ago, it's a smaller piece, isn't it, a chromosome?
No, actually, the chromosome is the organizer for the DNA. I have a really nice visual here to show you that. If this is the DNA molecule, so this ribbon is a symbol for the DNA helix. You can see what happens to cram that DNA into your cells is that we wrap the DNA around proteins. These are called histone proteins. And then these histone proteins are wrapped into a 30 nanometer fiber, and these fibers are wrapped into these loops, and these loops are wrapped into the rosette. And you can see that in one coil you get 30 rosettes, and from those rosettes, those are what you see on the electron microscope. So this process of having a DNA that's wrappable and having proteins that perform various functions along this way allows you to get that DNA, all that DNA into your cells.
Yeah. Now this is an actual DNA strand, or did you?
It's a lot of DNA. A strand. It would have to be a lot, because that's the only way we can see it.
Yeah. From what?
That, I believe, is from calf thymus DNA. For some reason, calf thymus is a source that the scientific companies use to isolate DNA. Without the calf's permission, I'm sure. How are we coming here? To the stuff
stuff? On a smaller scale.
Okay. All right, so we are actually to the point now where we think we're going to be able to get some DNA out of our onion. And we can spend a moment in connectedness with our onion. It's a little scary. You're going to go to lunch and eat DNA. Oh, no. DNA has right now the DNA would be dissolved in the goopy, soapy water solution, and what we add at the very end is rubbing alcohol. And if you just swirl the glass rod, you should start to see what it looks like snot. You'll be able to see it here. You see anything forming?
Yeah.
Okay. See?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I see it. Yep. You want to make a show? I don't know if you want to. Do you want to sit and have people come up and look at the DNA?
No.
You want to get more?
No, we got it.
You got it. DNA in your kitchen. Apparently, there's some energetic preschool teacher who does this with 4-year-olds.
Me. You've been busy for an hour.
I guess. There it is.
I spent hours in graduate school 20 years ago trying to wrap it on a glass rod. You just did it with household stuff.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
That's how far it's progressed.
Anybody else want to see this?
DNA technician, and he didn't even know it.
No.
That white, stringy, snotty stuff, and if we got the liquid out of it, it would look like the white thread you saw in the tube.
So then now you've actually seen DNA.
That's right, onion DNA.
So we just take that and compost, and we can improve the food quality?
Yeah. Really?
See, pizza DNA.
Yeah, right. Well, you've been a great group to work with. Any final questions or comments about DNA, about experiencing connectedness? I think you can see I'm trying to do something a little different with our scientific knowledge, all right? We don't often take time in science to sit down and appreciate the wonder because it's become such a major enterprise now with a lot of corporate bucks going towards this science that, you know, very often even our scientists don't have a chance to sit down and talk like we are talking and go, wow, I mean, this is really wow, you know? What the human mind can accomplish and what nature we have out there. So the way I'm connecting all of this work to guide our feet is as we walk, we very often, if we're lucky enough, have eyes to guide us as we look to move. And those eyes now, we know that we can see more where we know more. And then the final connection is, so now we've got our eyes and our mind involved in this process of walking through life, but also I think we need to not forget to add this part. And let's connect. What happens? What different knowledge can we get if we spend some time feeling this connectedness towards?
What kind of judgment should we exercise?
Right. So I encourage you as you think about guide your feet to think about eyes, heart, and mind.
I'll tell you a really short story about Fritz Neustadt, who was an interim director up here at Holden right after Carol Hendley, and. I was his pastor, and I was at Faith Lutheran in Leavenworth, where Rich Kammerer is a member, who's one of the artists who did all of the art in the gymnasium. Okay, and Rich was making a series of bulletins for church bulletin covers, and we got to this one, and it was beautiful. It was this gold. Crystal background. It was really dynamic, beautiful. Awe and wonder was what Fritz always called stuff. And we asked what it was, and Rich had taken one of Fritz's slides of his urine crystals and used it as the background on this church bulletin art. So if you haven't really seen it up there, but that's awe and wonder.
Yeah.
If you can. Part of your worship.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed being with you this morning. It's really feel much more connected than I did earlier.
Appreciate your thoughts and ideas.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You get it wrapped around the rod, or just keep going off.
Yeah.
We have to take out, show Mike and Jamil in the kitchen. They were helpful in getting us going. Mm-hmm. Thanks for your comment. I loved your comment.
Oh.
About the molecules and oh, that's terrific.
Yes.
Okay. It does, doesn't it?
You know how Native Americans used to think that they would take on the characteristics of the animal. Wouldn't it be weird if it turned out to be somewhat true, you know?
That'd be something. And you could actually show that molecularly.
Yeah.
That is really.
But when we digest, we break everything down into its, seems like a lot of wood, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. Think about all the cellulose and all these trees and the leaves.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really interesting comment. Wouldn't it be interesting if it were somehow true? Why wouldn't it be true? How would you, I mean, what definition are you using of truth to say that it isn't? That if you like when we hiked up, I caught a kokanee salmon down at the CERN, and I had all of the kids eat a piece of it because I said, if you eat a piece of salmon before your journey, you take on the salmon's strength for a long journey.
What do you use for bait?
I had a mess, so like a rooster tail.
Rooster tail.
Like a rooster tail. It had a little orange bead. And I fished it deep.
Mm.
About a pound and a half.
Did you use a drop sinker on your line, or you just went just
passed it, let it sink. Let it sink for about 15 seconds, and then slow retreat.
If you trace it all the way back to the we are stardust. I mean, the elements in us, you know, originated in
supernova. Silver, right?
It's kind of,
I want to get down there and try it.
I'm so happy to talk to you because I went to a conference about a month ago. There was a women in science conference. Met a woman.
Use
biochemist.
The time of day. Yeah. Get you
oh, yeah.
What a trip, right? And so I started talking to her about what I've been thinking about this idea of So I was maybe you get some kind of network going on. People who have this perspective and can show how you can use chemistry to. So would you mind giving me your name and an email or an address or something that but maybe if something, she and I can do something, we can have some discussion too, because I really appreciate your comments, really.
I'm too tired to walk that far and fish.
Yeah.
I brought 7 12 to 15 year olds. I had not, only one of them had ever had a backpack on.
Oh, that's terrific. What a great experience for kids.
I just want to go sit in the hot tub.
Yeah.
Well, I'm appreciative of your work with them, even though I don't even know them. You say you're from, now where are you from?
I'm in Pasco, Tracy. It's Hanford.
Oh, my gosh.
Everybody knows Hanford.
I have a friend who works up there. I heard him say that he thinks that the coyotes are shitting radioactive.
I don't doubt it at all. Mm-hmm. I was pastor in Leavenworth for 6 years and had one person with cancer in the 6 years I was there.
Mm.
I've been pastor in Pasco for 9 months and I've had 14.
Oh, no kidding.
So I think there's something to it.
Right, right. But that is scary. Oh, it's so great to talk with you.
Oh, you too.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you. See you.
See you. Have a good day.
Mm-hmm.
You too. Thanks for your comments, sir.
Okay.